Hello, and thank you for listening to the Skeptics in the Pub online podcast. This unedited audio is taken from 2,000 Mules and One Big Lie, A Stubborn Conspiracy Theory, by Jim Cliff. It was first broadcast live on Thursday, 25th of July, 2024. A video of this and many of the recordings hosted by Skeptics in the Pub online are still available on our YouTube channel. We hope you enjoy this podcast, and if you'd like to support what we do, you can join our Patreon. Find us at Patreon, Skeptics in the Pub online.
Thank you very much. So, as Dave mentioned, I host a podcast about American politics, and it's been pretty quiet a couple of weeks, so I've had plenty of time to work on this talk. When I started to write it, I wasn't sure how many people would have heard of or maybe even seen the film 2,000 Mules. So I asked Dave, and he did a quick straw poll of the Skeptics in the Pub organisers, and most of them hadn't heard about it. So I'm going to start from the very beginning, and if I tell you stuff you already know, well, that's Dave's fault. So this is Donald Trump. He lost the 2020 election, but he's a whiny little narcissist, so he didn't accept that. His supporters started inventing or propagating various conspiracy theories to explain why the most unpopular president in history lost an election. Enter this guy, Dinesh D'Souza, conservative filmmaker and convicted felon, who was pardoned by Trump. I want to make a couple of things clear. First, this isn't his real mugshot. The real one wasn't made public. Dinesh created this one when he reconstructed his arrest for a previous film of his as evidence of how much conservatives are persecuted merely for committing crimes like making illegal campaign contributions. Secondly, I'm not suggesting that his film about election fraud should be dismissed and or ridiculed because he's a convicted felon, or even because he has a track record of pushing debunked conspiracy theories in the past. It's totally possible that a conspiracy theorist who pled guilty to election-related crimes could make an accurate and truthful documentary about election fraud. Instead, Dinesh made 2,000 Mules. 2,000 Mules is a documentary-shaped film released in May of 2022 about one theory of how the evil Democrats stole the election from Trump. The reason I bring up Dinesh's past, and why I'll do the same for a couple of the other contributors in the film, is that we're asked to accept so many of their claims in the film on faith. And in this situation, it's only logical to consider the source of unevidenced information. Which brings us to these two, Catherine Engelbrecht and Greg Phillips of True the Vote. Catherine was not involved in politics at all prior to 2008, but she found herself sickened by the election of President Obama and started attending right-wing Tea Party rallies in Houston. Within a few months, she'd started her own Tea Party-affiliated group, the King Street Patriots. Greg claims to have 40 years of international experience in election integrity. But apart from a couple of short-lived fundraising roles, his only politics-based jobs appear to be running the Departments of Health and Human Services in Mississippi and Texas. Each job lasted less than 2 years and ended with accusations of ethical and financial misconduct related to Greg awarding lucrative contracts to companies he was affiliated with. More relevant, though, is a claim that Greg made on Twitter immediately following the 2016 election. He wrote, "Completed analysis of database of 180 million voter registrations. Number of non-citizen votes exceeds 3 million. 2 days later, he said they'd verified the 3 million non-citizen votes. Trump got very excited about this because obviously all of those voted for Hillary, so that meant that he won the popular vote as well as the election. Naturally, journalists were curious to find out more, but despite claiming on November 13th that his information was verified, he claimed he needed more time to check his data. When he appeared on CNN in January 2017, he told Chris Cuomo, "We're going to release all of this to the public. We're going to release our methodology and release the broad data and our conclusions, and we're going to release everything to the public as soon as we get done with the checks." More than 7 years later, we're still waiting. So that's who we're dealing with. 2,000 Mules is packed with unsubstantiated allegations, most of which don't even support the general premise of the film, but instead gently challenge the idea that the 2020 election was secure. We're treated to a variety of mutually exclusive conspiracy theories using cherry-picked news clips, right-wing radio hosts like Dennis Prager and Charlie Kirk, and dubious sources like Project Veritas. We're told about other verified cases of voter fraud, all of which are small-scale operations which were quickly uncovered by authorities, and many of which were done by Republicans. And we hear claims about dark money donations from liberal billionaires, supposedly contingent on the massive use of mail-in voting. But this is only a 45-minute talk, and we're already almost 5 minutes in, so I'm just going to talk about the 28 minutes of this feature-length film, which could loosely be said to involve evidence. And that's the section with Greg and Catherine. As you might remember, the 2020 election took place during a pandemic. So to reduce the number of people gathering together in one place to vote, a lot of US cities installed these kind of secure mail-in drop boxes for people to drop off their postal votes rather than voting in person. In most places, voting by mail was already used by a lot of people, but the pandemic increased the use of these drop boxes enormously. As far as Greg and Catherine are concerned, these were key to their theory of how the Democrats stole the election from Donald Trump and how they would prove it using cell phone data and video. The theory is based around what they call ballot trafficking, where individuals who they call mules put ballots, which presumably contain Biden votes, in different drop boxes all around the city. They get these ballots from left-wing nonprofit organizations. It's not clear where the nonprofits get the ballots, or whether the ballots themselves are actually illegal. There are some wild theories proposed later in the film about them being in the name of dead people or people who've moved away or voted in a different state, but no attempt is made at all to provide any kind of evidence for any of this. Given that they don't know where the ballots came from or who they were technically voting for, even if they could prove the claim that people were putting ballots into lots of different drop boxes, it's hard to see how that translates directly into illegal votes for Biden. But their argument is, it's weird. And as is often the case with conspiracy theorists, that's enough. There's a lot of anomaly hunting in this film. It is full of times where they will point something out either in the video evidence or their data that they've collected and essentially just say, that's a bit weird, and decide that it's evidence of voter fraud. Posting multiple ballots in a drop box isn't necessarily illegal. In lots of states, including the only one they have video for, you can post your family members' ballots, people you share a house with, people you provide care for. And in some states, there are even fewer restrictions. So just showing someone posting a handful of ballots isn't enough to prove anything. So to make it suspicious enough to suggest fraud, they make two main claims. One is that people are being paid to deliver lots of ballots, which would be illegal. The other is that they can show that these people went to lots of different drop boxes. And why would anyone need to do that, even if they were dropping off family members' ballots? That's a bit weird. The claim about people being paid is raised a few times, but no evidence is ever provided. While it's not mentioned in the film, Through the Vote have claimed on their website, in interviews and in affidavits, that an informant who claimed to be a mule told them that he was paid $10 a ballot, which is huge. Somebody actually admits it. Apparently, he laid out all of the evidence of the scheme, all of the details, and verifies everything that they claim in the film. So, I mean, you have to admit that's pretty strong evidence. When True the Vote told Georgia's Secretary of State about him, they even gave his name, John Doe. Yeah, he only agreed to speak to True the Vote on condition of anonymity, and he'll only talk to them. In fact, when authorities subpoenaed True the Vote to get his information, they said that they didn't have his identity, his address, or apparently any notes or videos of interviews that they'd done with him. But, you know, I'm sure he was real, right? We can probably just take their word for it. So, in the absence of showing that people were paid, the focus of the film is on proving that the mules visited lots of drop boxes. And their first line of evidence is cell phone geolocation data. I do realize we call them mobile phones, but this is all happening in the US, and my book is mainly for a US audience, so I'm going to talk about cell phones and measure things in feet. I hope you forgive me. Greg explains in the film that your phone is constantly emitting and receiving signals, which includes location data. And that data is gathered by apps on your phone, whether it's Google Maps or Uber or a weather app. Even apps that don't obviously need location data will collect it so that they can show you ads relevant to your location, like, for example, if you're close to a McDonald's. The other reason they collect this data is that they can then sell it to data brokers. True the Vote bought a ton of this data so that they could pinpoint where people had been during the election period. To try and convince us of the usefulness of the technology, They make various claims about how it's used by authorities and suggest that the police and the FBI must have been geo-tracking various people who were involved in the January 6th insurrection, because some of the people involved were arrested just a few days after January 6th. And it is true that there are cases where geolocation data was used in people's indictments. Unfortunately for their argument, none of the people who were arrested even in the first few months after January 6th were arrested because of geo-tracking. The fact is, a ton of the people who were involved in January 6th weren't exactly geniuses. They live-streamed their crimes, or posted photos about it on social media, or waved at press photographers. There were literally hundreds of thousands of tips to authorities by people turning in their relatives, their ex-husbands, their neighbours. There was also facial recognition software used to match images of suspects from 14,000 hours of CCTV footage from the Capitol and 2,000 hours of police body cam footage, as well as live streams, news reports, and so on. So while authorities eventually started using cell phone data as additional evidence, it was hardly ever the thing that helped them identify someone. Greg and Catherine bought this data for five states. Dinesh says that they are the states which tipped the election in Biden's favor, but that's not really true. Really, they were the states that Trump had won in 2016 and Biden won in 2020. And that, to them, was enough to render them suspicious. They weren't necessarily the closest states in terms of votes, although a couple of them were very close. But even then, they didn't focus on the states as a whole. They looked at the Democrat areas of those states. So for example, in Michigan, they looked at the Detroit area. In Georgia, they looked at the Atlanta metro area. So they ignored all of the more red rural areas of the state and focused only on the metropolitan Democratic areas. To avoid everyone of being a ballot mule, to avoid accusing that, they set a criteria that people that they consider to be a mule had to have been to at least 10 drop boxes or 10 unique visits to one or more drop boxes and five unique visits to one or more of the nonprofit organizations that they identified as Democrat. It's never made clear how they chose these organizations because they only kind of randomly decided that they must be where people are picking out the ballots from. There's no other theories considered about why people might go there. And crucially, they never name the organizations in the film. One thing you might notice if you watch real documentaries or read real investigative journalism is that when journalists accuse people of crimes, they've done sufficient due diligence to be confident in the accuracy of their reporting. As a consequence, they're prepared to name the accused individuals, safe in the knowledge that if they were to be sued, they could demonstrate that their belief was reasonable based on the evidence they've gathered. Greg, Catherine, and Dinesh accuse multiple individuals and organizations of crimes in this film, but they don't name a single organization, and they will assiduously blur the faces of every individual and one dog in their video evidence. I can only assume that this is because they're not confident in the reliability of their evidence, which is smart because it's bad. Dinesh planned to release the book of 2000 Mules on August 30th, 2022. As a subscriber to his mailing list, I was lucky enough to be sent an advance copy as a PDF while the publisher was shipping hardbacks out to the stores. Then on release day, the book was withdrawn from sale suddenly, and Dinesh tweeted an explanation. He said, "There's an elaborate sausage-making process that goes into a book. Somehow, a significant error got missed by the publisher. It is now corrected, but my book 2000 Mules is pushed back to October. I hadn't actually got around to reading my copy yet, but this spurred me into action. So I didn't find any of the usual reasons a publisher might recall a book, like major spelling mistakes, duplicate pages, forgotten placeholder texts. I did find, however, that Dinesh had named five of the nonprofit organizations. And sure enough, when the book was eventually released in October 2022, the names were nowhere to be seen. Anyway, using this geolocation method, True the Vote claimed to have found 242 people in Atlanta who fit their criteria of mules, as well as 100 in Milwaukee, 200 in Phoenix, 500 in Detroit, and over 1,100 in Philadelphia. By design, to make it easier for people to vote, drop boxes are placed in high traffic areas that people would have a reason to go to anyway. Depending on the state, that included community centers, libraries, busy street corners, college campuses, gyms, even apartment complexes. So you might wonder, how do you know that a person didn't just constantly pass by a Dropbox in their daily routine. Well, True the Vote thought of that, and they created a kind of control period by cleverly buying cell phone data from October 1st through to November 8th, 5 days after the election, so they could see the individual's normal patterns of life, and they could filter out anyone who still visited the Dropbox locations outside of the voting period. The trouble is that election experts Greg and Catherine don't understand elections. They chose October the 1st as a start date for their data because in most of their states that they were looking at, the early voting period starts during October. This is a slide from a presentation they gave to Wisconsin politicians, and you can see that their study period was October 20th until November 3rd, Election Day. That's because October 20th was the first day of early voting in Wisconsin. But there's a difference between in-person early voting and the period people can return mail-in ballots. In-person early voting doesn't involve drop boxes or mail-in ballots at all. It's the same process as voting on Election Day. You go to a polling location, pick up a ballot, and fill it in there and then. The only difference is you can do it before Election Day. By contrast, you can return your mail-in ballot either in a mailbox or a drop box the same day you receive it. And in many states, mail-in ballots are sent out well before in-person early voting starts. In Arizona, mail-in ballots were sent out on October 7th, but in Georgia, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, which together account for more than 1,800 of their 2,000 mules, Dropbox voting had already been underway for at least a week before they started gathering data. This means that for four of their states, the only non-voting period they have is the 5 days after the election, two of which were weekend days. It doesn't really feel like enough to build a pattern of life. Even if we were able to fully accept the pattern idea, though, there are some people whose daily lives just simply don't follow a set routine, such as Uber drivers, couriers, delivery drivers, temp workers, plumbers, first responders, journalists, even retired people. Then there are those whose routines might be affected by the election season, such as poll workers, elected officials, election workers who empty drop boxes, or volunteers who give out I voted stickers. Then there's anyone who was on vacation or off sick for those 5 days after the election, or lost their job, or got a new job, got married, had a kid, bought a puppy, bought a car, had an affair, changed the gym they go to, or any number of other reasons that people might change their routine. And because of that, they might be considered a mule by True the Vote. Catherine, however, insists that the addition of the nonprofits somehow makes it clearer, as well as what she calls the ability to identify the pattern of approach to a Dropbox and that it is going not past the Dropbox and on, but directly to a Dropbox. So my next question is, how precise is this data? Can they actually show that people went directly to a Dropbox? The data collected by different apps varies a bit, but for the most part, it's made up of cell site location information, GPS, Wi-Fi, and Bluetooth signals. Cell site location information, or CSLI, is the data gathered through triangulation between cell towers, or mobile phone masts, as they're usually called in the UK. In order for you to receive phone calls and text messages, your network has to know which towers are closest to you. So your phone sends out a signal to the nearest towers roughly every 8 minutes. It also sends the signal out when you turn on your phone, make a call, send a text, or use data. And data points are also collected every time you move into range of a new tower or receive a call or a text. In rural areas, you might only be within range of one tower at a time, which means that your location can only be narrowed down to a few square miles. In urban locations, there are far more towers. So the fact that the tower coverage areas overlap means that you can be located far more precisely, although some signals might be blocked by tall buildings, and really, it's still only good to within around 300 feet. In theory, some network providers can look at things like the angle at which the radio wave from your phone arrives at each cell tower, the strength of the signal, and even the difference in time that the signal arrives at different towers. By adding all this together, the absolute best case scenario is location within about 100 feet. We know that True the Vote data included CSLI data because they provided some of that to the Georgia Bureau of Investigation to try to get them to open an investigation into this voter fraud. App data, the kind that they bought usually also includes GPS data. And according to the US government, the typical accuracy of GPS-enabled smartphones under open sky is about 16 feet. However, that little phrase under open sky is crucial. To get the best accuracy, the phone needs to have line of sight to four satellites. So it's much worse near buildings, bridges, and trees. One study from the University of Georgia found that in an urban environment, the average error for a smartphone using only GPS was about 30 feet, and in some cases, as high as 120 feet. As well as signals being blocked by buildings, another reason it's worse in urban environments is a thing called multipath propagation, which is where signals arrive at your phone indirectly due to reflection, and that can cause interference. Wi-Fi is better than GPS indoors and in some urban settings because you don't need to see satellites, but in the University of Georgia study, there was only a slight improvement in accuracy when Wi-Fi was enabled over using GPS alone. Bluetooth is the most precise, staying accurate to within just a few feet, but it needs physical Bluetooth beacons to be installed where you're tracking people. And there's no reason to believe there were any Bluetooth beacons at any of the drop boxes or in those locations. Among the brokers who sell the kind of data that True the Vote bought, estimates of accuracy vary from about 20 feet to about 130. That's quite a wide range. So there's one other source that we could consult to figure out the accuracy of phone location data, which even the most skeptical observer would have to admit is not biased in our favor, Dinesh D'Souza himself. In an effort to prove his case, Dinesh twice tweeted out screenshots showing the location of his wife Debbie's phone at the time, once in August 2022 and then 2 months later in October 2022. Each time, he claimed Debbie was on the back balcony overlooking the pool. You might notice that Debbie appears to be in two different places. In fact, based on Dinesh's previous claim that his house is 6,200 square feet, these two locations are about 56 feet apart. So, I mean, it's nice of Dinesh to give us proof that he's wrong, but it's also strange that he doesn't seem to know where his back balcony is. Also, you see that large shaded circle around Debbie's location? That is the Google Maps display radius. Here's what Google has to say about that. The blue dot shows your location on the map. When Google Maps isn't sure about your location, there'll be a light blue circle around the blue dot. You might be anywhere within the light blue circle. The smaller the circle, the more certain the app is about your location. The radius of Debbie's circle at the smallest is around 120 feet, which gives an area of 45,000 square feet in which Google thinks she's located. That's more than seven houses the size of Dinesh and Debbie's. But we can't even stop there because Google isn't even sure she's definitely in that circle. According to Google, they always aim to be 68% confident that a device is somewhere within the display radius. So that's a 68% confidence area. So around a third of the time, you're not even in that blue circle. Sadly, they don't show us any of the geo-tracking data in the film. The closest they get is this map, which Greg describes as a smoothed out pattern of life, which shows the route of one mule who visited 28 drop boxes and five organizations in one day. The orange dots are the drop boxes. There are 29 of those dots, by the way, so they can't even get that right. Also, when you overlay the locations of actual drop boxes on the map, they don't really match up. Only 10 are within half a mile of their orange dots. When asked about this, Greg told the Washington Post, "The movie graphics are not literal interpretations of our data." First of all, that's not the impression given by the film, but more importantly, why make a fake one? They had the real route, supposedly, and they must have known exactly where all the drop boxes were, or this whole thing is a colossal waste of time. In a podcast interview, Catherine said that they physically went to the drop boxes to geofence around them. That's how they narrowed down the phone signals to find the mules, by the way. They created a virtual perimeter or geofence around the drop boxes. And when a phone signal's latitude and longitude fell inside that perimeter, that was considered a visit to the drop box. We don't know how large those geofences were because True the Vote won't say. They didn't answer when asked in congressional hearings and they didn't reply to my email. In the data that they gave to the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, one of their spreadsheets was titled "Devices within 100 feet of all or drop box by day." But it's not clear if that's the size of the geofence or it's just an acknowledgement of how imprecise geotracking is as a technology. Apple and Android tell app developers that the minimum practical geofence is about 100 meters or over 300 feet, which suggests that this method might not work for figuring out if someone used a Dropbox. But just for now, let's forget all of that. Let's give them all of the benefit of the doubt and assume that they can use geotracking to prove exactly where someone was to within just a couple of feet. If they've got the Dropbox locations wrong, like on that map, it's all useless, right? But they said that that pattern of life map isn't a literal interpretation of their data, so it's not fair to judge them on that. But in an affidavit in Georgia, they gave the coordinates of 26 Dropboxes. The locations are obviously going to be right because Catherine said they physically went there and measured, but just to be sure, I thought I'd check. First, I found pictures of the actual Dropboxes during election season by searching news reports, Street View, Google Earth, stock photo sites, and social media. This one's outside the Wolf Creek Library in Fulton County. Then I turned those pictures into coordinates using Google Earth and compared my coordinates to True the Votes. I started, of course, at the top of the list with the Dropbox at Cobb County Fire Station number 13. The black circle there is True the Votes coordinates. They got the right building. But it's a big building, and the actual Dropbox was outside. It's that red map pin on the right. That's 82 feet away, which isn't great, but at least it's within their own 100-foot margin of error. I'm not sure that's what they meant by that, though. At this point, I figured that probably this pattern would continue, that they would have correctly located the building, but gone no further in making any effort to identify the actual location of the box. However, the next on the list, West Cobb Regional Library, was not quite as close. The Dropbox itself was, not surprisingly, outside the main entrance of the library, but the True the Vote coordinates pointed to a residential area almost a mile and a half away. In the end, out of 26 boxes, their average error was almost a quarter of a mile, with three about a mile or more out. The only other data we have from them is this map from their website, which shows the full times and coordinates of a journey taken by one device in Arizona on the afternoon of Friday, October 23rd. There's one visit on the Wednesday to the county elections office, and then on Friday afternoon, this person visited six city halls and one library. The coordinates are all pretty accurate in that they point to the car parks of all of those buildings. The only trouble is that in Arizona, a lot of the drop boxes at government buildings are inside. So I couldn't find pictures of the more kind of specifically geolocate their locations. The issue for True the Vote is that three of the seven drop boxes this person supposedly visited were closed that day, and in fact every Friday during the election period. So with some of the only data they've made public, they've conclusively proved that Dinesh's assertion that there's no other reason to visit multiple Dropbox locations other than to stuff them with ballots is wrong. There must have been another reason. I'm guessing, this is purely speculation on my part, that this was probably a delivery driver who supplies Maricopa County government buildings with toilet paper or bottled water or refills their vending machines or something. So the geolocation data is a bust, but what about video evidence? Greg tells Dinesh that they have 4 million minutes of surveillance video from around the country. This is official CCTV footage recorded by the state governments, which True the Vote got through Freedom of Information style requests. That's over 7.5 years of video. So that's a lot of video. If there's anything dodgy going on, they'll definitely have found incontrovertible evidence. And since they went to the trouble of making a whole documentary about it, there must be some pretty juicy stuff coming up. They certainly wouldn't waste everyone's time by showing you completely normal voting going on and then actively lie about what you're watching while you're watching it. That would be crazy. While they claim to have video from multiple states, and I know from correspondence and their correspondence on their website that they have video from at least 30 drop boxes in Georgia, we only get to see footage from 12 boxes in one county in Georgia and a single box in another. This is Dogwood Library in Fulton County, and their code name for this guy is Multiples, even though he only has two ballots at most. But when he's trying to fit them in through the slot, he drops one. They find this both hilarious and suspicious and claim that they have loads of videos of people trying to stuff so many ballots in that they drop some. They don't actually show us any of the others, but I'm sure they're telling the truth. They find the fact that he's voting in the middle of the night suspicious, because presumably none of them have ever worked a job with unsociable hours. And they claim that they have him in a number of different locations at a number of different times. Do we get to see him at other locations? No. In fact, we don't see anyone at more than one Dropbox. It feels like we should, right? I mean, if it's central to their claim that people went to lots of different Dropboxes and they have more than 7 years worth of video, they must have one example. When asked about this, they claim that some states didn't provide them with video, and in some places the video was poor quality or not really pointed at the Dropboxes well, so it was impossible to identify people. The thing is, this guy is supposedly the one who visited 28 Dropboxes and 5 organizations in one day, and 7 of those 28 Dropboxes are ones that they show video footage from in the film, so we know they have it. It should be trivial for them to prove this. Supposedly, they tracked this guy's phone, so they know exactly when he showed up at each Dropbox. So it should be pretty quick to find him on the videos. But no. We never see this guy. We never see anyone twice. They never try to demonstrate any actual link between their geodata and the videos. And although that they claim that each mule dropped off an average of 5 ballots at each box, we never see anyone post more than 6, and most of the videos only show 1 or 2. They're not showing these videos as examples of stuffing an implausible number of ballots into Dropboxes, because they simply don't have video of people doing that. So instead, they focus on anomalies. In this case, it was dropping one on the ground and voting late at night. Before moving on to the next video, we get a lovely bit of B-roll of Greg looking over the shoulder of one of his analysts at this screen. The little insert is a video of one of the Atlanta Dropboxes, but the map isn't Atlanta. Atlanta doesn't have a river running through it like that city does. Turns out that is a stock animation of Moscow, which is fun. They could have used a map of Atlanta. We know they have one because they used it in the opening credits, but who cares about accuracy in a documentary? Anyway, on to the next video. This is Glove Lady, who provided a couple of anomalies that they could latch onto. After posting her single ballot, this woman took her blue surgical gloves off and popped them in the bin behind her before going back to her car. I know that doesn't sound suspicious, but what you don't realize is when she was walking to the Dropbox, she didn't look at the bin. So how did she know it was there? The only possible explanation is that she's been there before and is therefore committing a felony. For some reason, they don't consider the existence of peripheral vision or the fact that after she posts her ballot, she stands facing the bin for several seconds while taking her gloves off. More importantly, though, why was she wearing gloves in the first place? You might think it could have something to do with the global pandemic, but you're not thinking like a conspiracy theorist. They don't even mention COVID as a possible explanation because they've got a far more sinister theory. This particular video is from the Senate runoff election in Georgia in January 2021. And Greg says that they only really started seeing these surgical gloves after December 23rd, and they realized that on December 22nd, there was an indictment handed down in Arizona for ballot trafficking, and the way the FBI caught them was from fingerprints. So after that, everyone was warned to wear gloves. First of all, we just have to take on faith the idea that they only started seeing surgical gloves after December 23rd. I was able to get video of one of the Dropboxes from the general election in Georgia, and I watched 4 whole days worth of video from October. Around 5% of the voters in that video wore gloves to vote. But I don't have any data on what Greg and his team looked at, so maybe they saw a massive uptick in glovage after December 23rd. Incidentally, I wasn't only looking for gloves when I spent 96 hours watching people vote. I did find much more useful information. So could it be that this is because of the indictment handed down on December 22nd that was a result of FBI fingerprinting? Well, first of all, the indictment was actually handed down on December 7th. The Arizona Attorney General's office issued a press release about it on December 23rd, so maybe that's what he was talking about. The thing is, neither the indictment nor the press release says anything about fingerprints. Neither does that day's report in the Arizona Mirror or on AZ Central. In fact, I couldn't find a single story about the case that mentioned fingerprints until 2022, when one of the people involved took a plea deal. The Washington Post asked Dinesh about this, pointing out that the issue of fingerprints in this case wasn't public knowledge at the time, and Dinesh said Well, it doesn't have to be publicly known to be known by the organisers of ballot trafficking, which is an excellent point, unless you think about it. The two suspects in this case were charged on December 7th. According to the prosecution report, their fingerprints were taken on or before September 14th. But rather than warn their co-conspirators, they let everyone else continue to leave fingerprints until the day a press release came out that didn't mention fingerprints, at which point everyone started wearing gloves. Or maybe it's COVID. This is Bike Guy. Bike Guy rides his bike up to the box, takes a single ballot out of his backpack and pops it in. While he's doing that, they play sinister music and lie about him digging around in his backpack for multiple ballots while we're watching him not do that. Then he gets off his bike, leans it up against the drop box and takes a photo. Greg says, we see him get sort of frustrated as he starts to leave because guess what? At this point, they'd started requiring the mules apparently to take pictures of the stuffing of the ballots. It appears that that's how they get paid. Despite the fact that we haven't seen any evidence that they got paid at all, and that we see videos that were taken after this one where people didn't take photos, they can't think of any other reason why people would take a photo other than to prove you've posted an illegal ballot so that you can get paid for it. And they point out that this is not a selfie, but a photo of the Dropbox. Not one of them is aware of the existence of social media, apparently, where people routinely post evidence that they voted in part in order to encourage other people to do the same. Here's a few examples of photos people took as they posted their ballots in 2020. In the 4 days worth of video I watched of people voting, 154 of them took photos. That's a little more than 5% of all the voters. Of those, 65 were selfies, 54 were of ballots going in, like these ones, and 35 were just of the box itself, like the Bike Guy photo. All of those were before the Bike Guy video, when they'd started apparently requiring photos. Apart from the fact that this is just yet another claim with no evidence to back it up, it doesn't make any sense. A photo of the drop box doesn't prove you put any ballots in the box. Even a photo of the ballots going in like these doesn't prove that they actually went in. An unscrupulous mule could take a photo like this and then avoid committing a felony by not actually putting the ballots in and still get paid. Apart from not working, it's not necessary. Records on whether someone has voted are public in the US. The people running this scheme could check whether the ballots assigned to that mule had been posted simply by checking a website. That would be more reliable. And you might think that people running a multi-state conspiracy involving thousands of people committing federal crimes on their instructions would be quite keen to minimize the amount of photographic evidence of their crimes. This is Dog Guy. And yes, they have blurred the dog. Presumably it was a very recognizable dog, and Dinesh didn't want to be sued. This person also takes a photo with his phone as he posts a single ballot. And this time, what they're suspicious about is the fact that it's happening in broad daylight. Before, voting at night was somehow suspicious of somehow evidence of malicious intent. But they marvel at how brazen this person is, doing it right there in the open, in front of people who are queuing up to vote in person inside the library. There is nothing odd about what this person is doing at all. They are just voting. I can't emphasize enough how weird it is that this is one of the four videos they chose to focus on and spend time on in an effort to prove election fraud is happening. In the absence of anything else to talk about, Catherine decides to tell us what's going on inside the minds of the people in the queue. She says, they wonder, what does this all even mean if this is happening in broad daylight and nobody is doing anything to stop it? This is a documentary. Incidentally, just like in 2016, True the Vote promised they would release all the geotracking and all of the video footage to the public so everyone could see the proof for themselves. Just like in 2016, they did not do that. This is Mark Andrews. No, he doesn't have a cool name like Bike Guy or Dog Guy, and the film certainly doesn't name him. The reason we know he's Mark Andrews is because Dinesh very unwisely chose this bit of footage to play while he says in voiceover, what you are seeing is a crime. These are fraudulent votes. And Mark Andrews sued him. He sued Dinesh, True the Vote, and the film's producers, the Salem Media Group. An unblurred version of this clip of Mr. Andrews posting 5 ballots was sent to the Georgia State Election Board as evidence of criminal activity. Their investigator identified him from his license plate and interviewed him. And he said the ballots were for him, his wife, and his 3 adult children who live at home with him, all of which is legal in Georgia. The investigators checked public records and found that there were 5 legal electors living in the home, all family members, and using the state's voter verification system, determined that ballots for all 5 of the voters were dropped at the drop box in question on the date the video was taken. So if he was a mule who visited multiple drop boxes and dropped off hundreds of ballots, how incredibly lucky that the only time he was apparently caught on video was on the same exact day that he and his family's ballots were all put into this exact drop box. What are the chances? The investigation against him was dismissed just a few days before the premiere of 2000 Mules. At the end of May this year, the film's producers, the Salem Media Group, paid Mark Andrews a significant settlement, made a public apology, and removed both the film and Dinesh's book, which they published, from their platforms. But the film is still available because while Salem backed down, Dinesh and True the Vote refused to settle and are continuing to fight the lawsuit. You can still stream it on Dinesh's Locals channel or on Rumble. And election deniers still point to it as definitive proof of fraud because they refuse to check a single claim it makes in case their beliefs are shaken. And when Trump loses to Kamala Harris in November, these same claims will be repeated. And Trump and some of his most fervent followers will remain convinced that this film holds the key to why he lost. So, if you see someone online telling liberals to watch 2000 Mules if they want to know the truth, point them towards my book. They won't read it, but maybe other people who see the exchange might find out that the whole thing's a bit more complicated than it seems. Thanks very much.
Welcome back, everybody. You had a good chance to refill your drinks. We will now get into the Q&A for Jim. So we will start with the standard question that has been nicely reworded for this one of, are there any pets that need unblurring?
Sadly not. No, I don't have any pets.
Sadly not. But that does move us nicely into the question about the blurred dog. The blurred out dog looked really shifty. What did it have to hide? Not a good boy?
No, it was up to some shenanigans, I'm sure. Yeah, no, Dinesh was asked about the dog. And he said that it was the insurance company lawyers who insisted. He was asked about the dog, and then he said that they insisted about blurring faces and kind of just glazed over the fact that he also blurred the dog. But maybe it was just a very specifically recognizable dog. I suppose the thing is, you can only post ballots in the county that you live in. So the number of people who voted in that county does reduce the number. And then when you know that that it's one of those people who has a particular breed of dog, it does make them more identifiable, I guess. So,
yeah, I suppose also if you see them regularly walking around in a pair of grey trousers and a dog that looks like that, might put 2 and 2 together and go, actually, that's him. And that's identifiable information. Moving on to a question from an anonymous. I hear that many right-wing outlets weren't impressed by this documentary either. Is Dinesh still prominent in these circles, or has he been pushed aside?
He is pretty prominent still, but Fox News famously had a little bit of issue with Dominion voting systems, where they ended up having to pay quite an enormous amount of money. And after they got sued, basically, they were quite careful. Or no, that's not fair. They weren't careful. They became more cautious about exactly what words they would use and making specific allegations. And this film makes specific allegations. And so, yeah, I think they were wary about pushing it. And people like Ben Shapiro kind of came out and said, yeah, it doesn't really prove anything. So there was a lot of people who showed a lot of support. Weirdly, some of them happened to be bankrolled by Salem Media, people like Charlie Kirk, for example, who they syndicate his radio show. People who had some extra financial stake seemed very confident about it and keen on pushing it.
because you didn't particularly mention this in the in your talk, the last third of the film, it's actually probably more of that, is basically just four men standing around commenting on video, or sort of four people standing around commenting on video.
It's very weird, yeah. Dinesh was required by Salem to use some of their other hosts in his film as a kind of contractual thing. So there's Dennis Prager, there's Charlie Kirk, there's Sebastian Gorka, and Eric Metaxas, and one of the whose name I forget for the moment. But I have never seen a documentary where in part of the documentary, people are commenting on the other part of the documentary. And that's just because they show us the video clips and talk about them. And then they show those guys the video clips and they basically say the same stuff. It really feels like it's kind of trying to pad desperately out to feature length. But
also a lot more controversial comments made by those hosts, as opposed to Dinesh saying them himself. It's more, let's let these people say some of the more "that's a crime" type comments.
Yeah. And there's some really lackluster attempt to pretend they're independent. Like Dennis Prager acts like he's not sure that the election was stolen until they show him the evidence, and then he's completely convinced. So, yeah.
On the topic of sort of liability, can the Awesome asks, can the organizations, individuals named in the original unpublished version of the book still sue since they were named?
I mean, it was given out to a number of people. So theoretically, I guess they could, but probably that would draw more attention to it that they don't want to. In fact, the NPR did contact a couple of them because they managed to get an early copy of the book. And the ones that were prepared to be named said, you know, we don't want to give this any more oxygen, essentially. And we're glad that they've decided not to include our name in the book. And I've identified actually probably 15 or so of the organizations through various means. I won't be naming them in the book. I've contacted a few and they've said that they don't want to comment. So I think it's easier for everyone if they just kind of keep quiet about it, because most people aren't looking into this stuff. That's the thing. They're watching the film, taking it on face value, believing it, and telling liberals that they're blind if they don't think this is evidence of voter fraud.
So moving on to a question from Igor, do you expect them to be as crazy about the upcoming election as they were about the previous one? Will they try the same BS, or will they have to change their tune?
I think they will definitely try this again. I think they consider this proof that the 2020 election was stolen, and that Democrats are definitely going to do it again. And they are using it. In fact, in places like Wisconsin, they tried to get the drop boxes made illegal, essentially, partly on the basis of the evidence in the film. So they're using it in various locations, especially where there's Republican secretaries of state or state officials who they can take this to and say, look at what Democrats do. We have to make it harder for people to vote.
Nick G asks, did you see anything funny in your days of video watching? There's got to have been something in there. There's got to have been somebody tripping over, or it's just something small.
I don't think I did. I saw, it was weirdly life affirming actually, because first of all, I saw a lot of people being really pumped up about the fact they'd voted. They were like, after they'd put their ballots in. I did see one argument that obviously there's no audio on it, so I couldn't figure out what it was about, but these two people, one just voted and one was pulling up to vote, and they had a shouting match that went on for a few minutes. I was kind of curious about that. There was an unhoused person who came and sat by the Dropbox for a while, and a surprising number of people who they talked to kind of voted and then went to their car and came back and gave them some money. And that was nice to see. But yeah, it was at times very boring and at times quite interesting to see the joy that people were experiencing, having actually kind of taken part in the process.
I mean, having voted in the UK, it's quite a nice environment. It, yeah. You know, you were there with a similar group of people who all want to have their say on current politics. You may not agree with each other on your politics, but that doesn't tend to be the topic. It tends to be, we voted. Yay.
Yeah.
Yay, democracy. Anonymous asks, did they organise the pandemic to make the mail-in voting fraud possible?
Well, I think Marsh organised the pandemic, didn't he? So I think you'd have to ask him. No, that is an argument that they will make. I mean, as you probably know, the right has a number of competing and mutually exclusive conspiracy theories that people somehow simultaneously believe. And yeah, the suggestion that if they didn't create it, then they used it as an excuse to create the circumstances to enable this to happen by massively increasing mail-in voting.
I think we know that most conspiracy theories breed another conspiracy theory, or at least people who believe in one have a tendency to believe in it, at least another one. We have a number of questions that have come in specifically about Dinesh himself. So we'll go into a little bit of that. So first of all, Nick G asks, does Dinesh know about you or your work? Have you ever spoken to him?
I haven't, no. I have emailed Dinesh and Through the Vote with various things that I wanted to clarify, but never had any reply. I kind of, in a way, hope he doesn't know about me yet, because I mean, although I'm being really careful about the stuff that I'm saying, you can, you know, people can theoretically sue you to kind of try and shut you up. So I'd rather that didn't happen, because I'm not rich. It'd be nice, I guess, if this does reach him, that he knows that someone has actually done something about it and tried to refute some of the arguments.
Has your publisher heard anything in terms of threats or, you know, do not release this?
Nope. I'm self-published, but it's going, I have talked to a lawyer about it to kind of get the best method to make sure that the risk is minimized at least. So.
Next question is from Anonymous again, still about Dinesh. What's your favourite Dinesh lie? I'm assuming you've watched more than just this documentary.
Yeah. I mean, we've also watched his more recent film, Police State, which suggests that if you're a conservative, basically the US is like South Korea, North Korea, which is the bad one. Anyway, that it's a fascist state already. And it's persecuting Christians and conservatives. But I think in this one, the lie that I found in a way harder to debunk because it is so obviously wrong on its face is that True the Vote is a nonpartisan organization. It was just, well, that is kind of one of the first things that Dinesh says when he meets with Greg and Catherine and to set up that this isn't, you know, a crusade from the right against the Democrats. They just happened to find that it was the Democrats that were doing all of the voting fraud. And it's mad. Everything about them is so right wing and comes from the Tea Party movement and the Republicans. I like struggle to figure out where to begin to point out how wrong that is.
Nick G again asks, if you could interview Dinesh and ask him three questions, what would they be?
He's already been interviewed quite a lot, so I actually kind of know what most of his answers would be to any of the questions that I would ask. Philip Bump in the Washington Post did a series of articles about it and did an interview with Dinesh. And also in his book, Dinesh answers some of the repeated things that come up in fact checks. Not satisfactorily, obviously, but he gives his response to them. So I don't feel like it would be very productive because all of the things I would have asked have already been asked and he's just kind of dismissed them as nonsense.
It's been asked but badly answered.
Yeah.
Anonymous asks, if you were going to do some election stealing shenanigans, how would you go about it? You've obviously looked into how it's done, I mean, or how they claim it's done.
Yeah, it actually would be incredibly difficult. I mean, one thing, if this method were in any way plausible at all, then one way it could have been done far more easily and with less evidence is that you can post a mail-in ballot in a regular US postal service box. And none of those have cameras on them. And they're all over the place. So geo-tracking would be kind of, it's useless already, but it would, you know, it wouldn't be weird if a person were to go to lots of post boxes. So just using post boxes for this exact process would make this one almost impossible to detect. But one thing that I obviously didn't have time to go into is that whereas in the UK, certainly in the recent election, you have your local MP that you're voting for, and you have the, you know, it's the each kind of county, there's what, 650 or so constituencies that have a ballot, and it's just a slip of paper with that printed on it. In the US, every single district, every kind of township, every small area has its own special ballot, and you're voting not just for the president and the party and your local congressman and your local senator, you're voting for the kind of some, in some places, judges and like the head of the local water board and all kinds of stuff. And every, and there's 3,500 counties or so in the US, and every single ballot is different. They're printed on different paper, they're laid out in a different way, they have different candidates. So creating fake ballots to insert into the process would be practically impossible. And so that's kind of what they're suggesting in a way, or one of the ways that they suggest these ballots could be is that actually they've just been created. They've been made out of nothing. So yeah, it's really secure.
If you were to use every single postbox, you could get a lot more data. If you ring fence every one of them as well.
Absolutely.
I mean, how many mules are there now? Must be exponentially larger if you use every single mailbox in America.
Yeah, well, I think when they do the math and figure out that if they multiply the number of mules that they found in Philadelphia with the average number of ballots and an average number of drop boxes they went to, the number they get to is actually higher than the number of mail-in ballots that were posted in Philadelphia.
Sort of on a similar note, Anonymous asks, are there any competing conspiracy theories explaining how it's rigged? And do you have a favourite?
Yes, millions of them. There's as many as there are Republicans. I think it's... do I have a favourite one? I think the idea that people get ballots in like the names of their dogs and stuff like that, and then somehow are allowed to vote, like that vote still counts, is insane. But
that's why the dog was blurred.
Yeah, maybe it was
the dog was voting.
Dog and the owner were both voters.
Igor asks, given that you spent so much time looking into US elections, do you think they're actually secure, or do you see some problems?
They're incredibly secure. Yeah, it's the process of, I mean, I talked about the different ballots in the different counties, but there's also within that, each ballot, essentially the envelopes are signed by the individual voters. The ballots are kind of barcoded to be assigned to that specific person. That when they are received, they check the signatures against the signatures that they hold against those people. If it's your first time doing mail-in voting, you have to provide proof of ID, social security numbers, driving license numbers, and so on. So you can't just kind of start doing mail-in voting without having applied to do so. And that's just the mail-in. I mean, there's an argument on the right that mail ballot voting is the way to do it fraudulently. I think actually, arguably, the just going to the polls and voting is less secure. Although it's still very secure because they still check every single vote against whether they've also had an absentee ballot for that person or whether that person has voted in other locations or all kinds of different things. So it's brutally checked. And that's why it takes several days to end up counting all the votes.
Question from Andrew. Is it suspicious that so many of this week's questions are anonymous? Is this evidence of question stuffing by mules?
Yeah, it might just be one person doing questions all over the place.
I mean, we've already got Igor doing that, but this is another one on top of the Igor questions. Anonymous asks, how big a thing was this film in the US? Are many people in the US using this film as evidence for their belief in the stolen election myth?
Yeah, sadly, it was pretty big. It was the most successful political documentary in over a decade. And it made, I think, $1.5 million in the first few days, $10 million within a few weeks. And yeah, it did very well. And it probably is still a niche. It's not like, it's not mainstream as such, although I think probably a lot of Americans who pay attention to politics will have heard about it. It was brought up in the January 6th hearings. It's mentioned in congressional hearings in lots of different states. And part of the reason I wanted to address it is it is one of the main things that a lot of different people will point to as evidence. You know, all of the different conspiracy theories, no one has gone to the trouble of pretending enough that they're real to make something of them. And Dinesh, for all his faults, went to quite a lot of effort to pretend this is real. And that has resonated with people.
I was talking to a friend about this the other day, and the fact that it's an hour and a half film, there is about 20 minutes of information in there at a push. Yep. It is very much, they've just padded it out to make it seem more than it is. Andrew asks, what do you anticipate Trump doing this year if he doesn't get his way in this election? And is that scarier than what he'll do if he does get it?
I don't think it. As scary as what he'll do if he gets in, because that's really scary. If you haven't heard about Project 2025, look that up. But if he doesn't, I wouldn't be at all surprised to see another kind of January 6th type event, and fueled by this kind of argument.
It's scary. Another question from Eagle. On a scale from Alex Jones's program on a Friday after a full bottle to regular Fox News slop, how unhinged is this one?
Unhinged is an interesting word, because it's reasonably hinged in terms of how soberly people talk about the stuff. No, it's completely illogical. You know, it doesn't. The arguments they make don't follow from each other. Several of them are mutually exclusive. They don't make sense, and they, they don't stand up to any kind of scrutiny. Not like strong scrutiny, but any, like the slightest thread that you pull. So many times when I was researching this, I would read another just a sentence that they'd said in a podcast interview or something that they'd written as a response to a question. And it was like, well, that is that right? And I check it. And it was almost always wrong. It's wrong all the way down. So it's put together in a way that really seems like a documentary if you have not seen many documentaries. And seems convincing if you're prepared already to accept everything they say. But as soon as you start to pull at any thread at all, it falls apart immediately.
I mean, I started watching the documentary, just watching it, and it was only about 10 minutes in before I thought, I need to start looking up some of this stuff. There's stuff in here that just doesn't add up to me. I don't know why. Something doesn't seem right
but
here.
But they're relying.
I don't have that knowledge.
That the vast majority of their audience aren't going to bother doing that. They're just going to take it and agree with it, because it's basically saying what they already think. It's just giving them a way to say, oh yeah, that I thought that already. That proves it. Yeah.
Also, a specific mechanism for how they've done it this time, rather than just they've stolen the vote. It's this is how they stole the vote. We have evidence of how they did it. This is, and again, once you start looking into it, once you start pulling that thread, the whole thing unravels and you realize, okay, there's a lot here that doesn't track. Igor asks, did you think about doing some collaborations with some other people who are doing podcasts about this thing, perhaps to analyze something of Alex Jones?
I mean, the Alex Jones thing suggests a knowledge fight, and I did talk to Jordan at last year's QED, not specifically about this, but kind of try and see if we could collaborate. We haven't got anything going yet about that, but yeah, I mean, there's a few internet researchers who've done a lot of great work on this, apart from people like Philip Bump at the Post. There's people on Twitter who kind of dedicate themselves quite a lot to putting out information that debunks some of this stuff, but also directly responding to people who are pushing this and saying this is real. And they'll go, actually, that thing you just said is not real, and here's why, and here's some evidence about it. And there's two or three of those that are pretty dedicated to that. And I've spoken to them and shared some information and back and forth. In fact, one of them was who helped me get hold of some, like the video of one of the drop boxes.
Nick has very kindly given us some sorbet to cleanse the palate a little bit here. What's your favorite logical fallacy?
I mean, there's probably no true Scotsman. Every episode that we do, I get really into that one for a little while, and I start seeing it places for weeks after we've talked about it. So it kind of varies from time to time. But yeah, straw man's good because it's easy to explain to people, and if you're quite new to logical fallacies, it's easy to understand, and it's a good way in, I think. So I'll go with that.
Lovely. Anonymous asks, unforeseen problems in the sausage making of your book? Did you run into any big challenges?
The amount of time that everything takes. The kind of origin of the book was largely that we started talking about this on our podcast, and we watched the film and then broke it down for our patrons over a long series of patron special episodes. And because I'd done all the research for that and thought we'd kind of pretty much covered everything, I thought this might make an interesting book, and I've already done all the research. And so, but when I started actually then trying to make it more formal and put it into book format and source things properly and make sure that I was being precise about the things I said, every step of that took such a long time. And there are periods where there's two sentences that they said in the film that I will then spend a couple of days tracking down the exact right source to show how wrong they are about the thing they just said. And when it's a 90-minute film and every couple of sentences takes that long, it snowballs.
And Anonymous again asks, what type of groundwork do you think conspiracy theorists are doing right now to prove that the next election has been rigged already? Well, will have been rigged too.
Yeah, I mean, the part of the work that Trump did in before the 2020 election, where he was saying that it was going to be rigged and that if he lost, that, you know, he could only lose if they stole it from him. And with the mail-in voting specifically as a method, was part of what led to this. So the fact that Trump discouraged so many Republicans from using mail-in drop boxes, especially during a pandemic, meant that a large proportion of the mail-in votes, which often got counted later, ended up being Democrat votes. And that meant that there's suspicion when the voting seems to be going towards Trump, and then when those mail votes come in,
the overnight mail votes.
Yeah, exactly. There's a big switch towards Democrats. So that's talked about in the film. It doesn't obviously support this theory at all, but if you know, the work that he did kind of put in beforehand, the groundwork that he was doing, led to things that they could claim afterwards as suspicious, and suspicion is all they need, because it's it's weirdly powerful them being able to just say, this is weird. So therefore,
this asks questions. Yeah. There's just questions to be asked about this.
So, yeah, I think Trump will probably do the same thing again. He'll be saying, you know, they haven't fixed the election integrity that we saw that there were problems with in 2020. And if, you know, I'm definitely going to win, but if I lose, it's because it was stolen from me and all of that kind of stuff.
So we are getting towards the end of the questions. Anonymous again asks, I found the Tea Party at the centre of troll promotion by probably English or Russian speakers. Was Twitter word of mouth a part of marketing the film?
I think to a certain extent, yes. I think it was, there is this ecosystem around the kind of the Salem Media Group particularly, and they have a network of radio shows and TV shows and internet shows with those hosts and others who all then interviewed each other about it and interviewed Dinesh and had him on for a few weeks before. And Trump had a premiere at Mar-a-Lago of the film in the beginning of May, where they invited lots of people along to talk about it, and, you know, right-wing journalists and that kind of stuff. So that was where most of the pre-release marketing came from. Once it was out there, there were a lot of right-wing voices online talking about it and saying how it's absolute proof, and if you don't believe it, you're brainwashed. And so that spreads it among anyone who listens to them.
This one I think you're going to want to be fairly careful with, but in your opinion, what proportion of this does Dinesh actually believe and what is pure grifting?
In my opinion,
thank you.
there are aspects of it that he possibly believes, and there are aspects of it that I find it difficult to believe he believes based on the presentation. There are, for example, there's bits of news reports that are used that are deliberately edited in a way to suggest that the news reporter said a thing they didn't say, where they've left the video running, but they've taken the audio and cut a bit out of it. I don't think you can do that as a film director or film editor without realizing that you're not telling the truth. And so, yeah, there's aspects to it where I think he is being deliberately manipulative and pushing a convenient argument.
And on that point, it is an area of your expertise, as in that is what you do. Video editing is your background.
It is.
Okay, we'll move on to the last question. And that is from Awesome. Did you spend more time researching and debunking their claims than they did putting it all together in the first place?
Definitely. I mean, it's a Gish Gallop of a film. That's the thing. It's so quick and easy to make these claims. And I mean, to be fair to them, they put in a lot of effort to pretend that it's more complicated and to, like, all of the stuff they did to act like they have proof took some effort and money and time to do, and they made a film about it, and they made choices that required more effort, like I said, making up the fake map instead of using a regular map, and filming all of the locations that they had in this documentary were sets. They weren't like the at one point we're in Dinesh and Debbie's house, but it's not really Dinesh and Debbie's house. They've hired a set. They could have just filmed in their house. That would have been more authentic for a documentary where you're trying to prove crimes happened. But so they went to, in some cases, more effort than they needed to. But for the most part, the assertions that they're making are lazy and they haven't. I think Dinesh realized that he didn't need to have gone to so much effort, because his next film, Police State, it's far sloppier, far, far less. He hasn't bothered really at all to try and pretend that he's providing evidence for anything in that one. This one, at least, they show you some things and then call them evidence.
we were talking during the break, that data that they got was not cheap. That is not the kind of stuff you just randomly pick up off a website and go, yeah, it's all good. They pay for that stuff.
I would say, I think Catherine Engelbrecht does believe this stuff, at least a lot of it. And she's the driving force of True the Vote. Greg, I'm more skeptical about, and Dinesh, I think, is saw it as a potential money-making exercise, in my opinion. But yeah, Catherine, I think, is a true believer. So there's a mixture.
So I would like to say thank you very much to Jim. Fantastic talk. Thank you very much to our audience, and good night, everybody.
That was the Skeptics in the Pub online podcast. For more skeptical content, including information about future talks, please like us on Facebook, follow at SITP on Twitter, or head to our website at sitp.online, where you'll also find a link to all the ways you can get in touch with us, including our Discord server. Music in this episode was provided by Thula Bora and used with permission. Until next time, thanks for listening.